Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Hello, and welcome to the latest instalment of Kingston Reid's A Word to the Wise podcast series. I'm Lucy Shanahan, a partner in our Sydney office, and I'm joined today by Jai Pan Zhao, senior associate. Hi, Jai. How are you going? Nice to be with you.
I'm doing well. Lovely to be with you as well, Lucy.
Excellent. Thanks. This year, Jai, we've seen a lot of the practical impacts, I guess, of the changes that were made to the Fair Work Act, really with a focus on bargaining. So we thought that we would have a chat about some of those practical impacts, focusing really on multi-employer bargaining and also the intractable workplace declarations and determinations, and just explore for a few minutes how those two changes to the Fair Work Act are really having an impact on how bargaining is happening now. So let's start with multi-employer bargaining. Jai, do you want to start there? What we can tell us about them?
Yeah, so what we know is that prior to the suite of amendments to the Fair Work Act, there was one type of multi-enterprise agreement. But now with the amendments, there are essentially three types, and those being cooperative workplace agreements, which are the words speak for themselves when two employers cooperate and want to bargain together. The second stream are the supported bargaining agreements, which start from a supported bargaining authorization, and they're traditionally targeted at low pay industries such as aged care, disability care. And the third stream,
I think we've seen a few of those supported bargaining applications come through the Fair Work Commission in those exact industries. So it's working exactly the way it was intended to work.
There we go. And I think it's bringing back a form of agreement.
Yeah. In the olden days.
And so the third stream is, I think, the real big ticket, and that is single interest employer agreements, which start with a single interest employer authorization. And Lucy, I don't know from your experience, do you think these type of multi-enterprise agreements have been common?
No, but I know I've had a lot of clients who've been quite concerned about particularly the multi-employer enterprise agreements. When the amendment was first made, there were a lot of questions from employers in industries who were concerned about what that would actually be. But no, I haven't. There hasn't been a lot of it other than whether supported applications is made.
And I guess that makes sense because at least with cooperative workplace agreements, they're going to be uncommon because unless there's related entities, employers aren't going to sit in the same room and willingly share what is potentially commercially sensitive information about retention strategies, rostering arrangements, which not only make its way into an EA, but ultimately make its way into the pricing of its services. So they're not going to do that. And the unions are going to be the ones that initiate multi-employer bargaining, predominantly under that third stream, the single interest employer agreements. So Lucy, from a practical perspective, what happens when an employer becomes involved in multi-employer bargaining?
Yeah, so once it becomes clear that there's an attempt being made to pull an employer into a multi-employer framework, and if an application is successful and, you know, the determination is effectively made, then what happens is that employer or that group of employers have to bargain together for a period of time. And what the different rights are with respect to, say, protected industrial action will depend upon the different type of multi-employer bargaining that is being engaged in. So an application for a protected action ballot order, which leads to protected industrial action, can't be made in relation to a cooperative workplace agreement. So even though we think it'll probably be quite rare that a cooperative workplace agreement would be made, that would certainly be a benefit, that there would be no protected industrial action that could be made during that bargaining period. In addition, an application for an intractable bargaining declaration can't be made unless there is a supported bargaining authorisation or a single interest employer authorisation is in operation in relation to the agreement. And I know we'll talk about this a bit later, but that effectively provides another tool for the Fair Work Commission to use in bargaining. So it makes sense that there would need to be that authorisation already in existence before you could actually make the application for the intractable bargaining declaration. Then the other really sort of, I guess, big ticket item is that once a multi-employer agreement has been approved, then other employers can be roped into that agreement as well, even if they were not involved in the bargaining process. Now, obviously, there has to be criteria met for that. It's not just that a union can say, hey, employer, you're now covered by this agreement. And the criteria includes things like the majority of the employees of the new employer want to be roped in. There are reasonably comparable operations and there's a common interest that exists between the various parties. So there are some barriers there that you have to actually get over before you can actually be roped in. And there's only these new provisions haven't really been considered or dealt with by the Fair Work Commission or courts until recently. And there was a recent decision handed down by the full bench, APESMA and Great Southern Energy Pty Limited, Delta Coal, Whitehaven Coal, Peabody Energy and Yulan Coal Mines. And Jai, I know you've read that decision, so
I have.
Can you tell us about it?
So it is a recent decision, somewhat recent. It was published at the end of August, and it's a decision of the full bench of the Fair Work Commission. I should just say at the outset that there is an application to appeal that decision, and the first case management hearing in the federal court was, I think, last week on the 8th of November. So this matter will make its way through the federal court, and we'll wait and see to see what happens there. But until the federal court makes a determination, this is binding law. And this decision is significant for a couple of reasons. When these multi-employer bargaining provisions were introduced, there was a general sentiment and concern that maybe it was going to be very hard for employers to resist getting dragged into these bargaining processes. And with this decision, we do get a feel as to whether the sentiment is true and correct. And would you agree with me, Lucy, that it's probably fair to say that it's somewhat true?
Yes.
And I think the other thing that's significant is those conditions you mentioned earlier, Lucy, about having reasonably comparable operations and common interests with the other bargaining entities. These conditions not only apply at the roping in stage when an agreement has been approved, but they also apply at the authorization seeking stage. So kicking it all off. And in fact, at the authorization stage, if an employer has over 50 employees and a union names them in the authorization application, then it is presumed that that employer has reasonably comparable operations and a common interest with the other employees. So that presumption's made.
Yeah. So the onus is on the employer to prove otherwise.
That's right. That's right. So the Delta Coal decision, if I can call it that, or the PESMA decision is really significant because it sets out quite firmly, at least, how the Fair Work Commission is going to interpret those conditions that apply both at the authorization stage and the roping in stage.
So what were the facts?
So the facts are APESMA made an application for a single interest employer authorization, and it wanted to force four employers operating within New South Wales, and they all mine black coal. They're in that industry. They wanted these four employers to bargain for a multi-enterprise agreement. And APESMA essentially argued that they should bargain together because they all operated underground mines. They all mined for the same type of product, black coal. They all operated in New South Wales. They were all covered by the same modern award. And the same legislative framework applied to all of them, both in respect of employment, so the Fair Work Act and the modern award applied, but also mining industry long service leave arrangements and the legislation there applied to them, and also broadly the regulatory frameworks for mine operators, whether it's workers' compensation or broader regulatory requirements, all that apply.
There was one other interesting aspect too, like APESMA has made the application, or Professionals Australia. So we're not dealing with blue-collar workers here. We're dealing with more with a white-collar, a supervisor, a professional, you know, an engineer. It's a different group of employees who are not necessarily usually considered or ordinarily considered to be covered by an enterprise agreement.
That's right. That's right. And as we can all imagine, the four employers, they want to do their own thing. They don't want to go to the bargaining table with their competitors, and so they all oppose this authorization.
So how did Delta get out of it?
Well, yes, Delta managed to get out of it. Now, from a legal perspective, they were able to argue that they rebutted the presumption and they were able to argue that they don't have identifiable common interests with the other employees and they don't have comparable operations. Now, even putting aside the law, if we just look at the facts and operations generally, Delta Coal was quite distinct. The other three all operated mines really for commercial gain or profit. They dug out coal and they sold it overseas for money. Delta Coal successfully demonstrated that its operations were really to facilitate the operations of the parent company that operated
right.
the power station.
Yep.
And so in other words, its purpose wasn't to sell coal for profit, but really to support a parent company and just do enough to cover its own operational costs. And another interesting fact that it put forward was it didn't have the facilities or resources to even transport coal to then sell it, apart from putting coal into the power stations. So all in all, its operations were quite bespoke and unique.
So why were the other three roped in then?
So going again, there's this presumption, provided the employers have over 50 employees, that there are clearly identifiable common interests and reasonably comparable operations. On the first condition, all three employers tried to advance different submissions to draw distinctions from each other. They tried to show there wasn't a common interest because they all operated in different locations. They used different mining methods. They used different equipment. They used different transport strategies and modes, and there were different geology concerns in their operations. Now, the Fair Work Commission, I think largely due to the drafting in the legislation, ultimately found that those three employees did have clearly identifiable common interests. The Fair Work Commission held that interests should be defined fairly broadly, and it includes concerns, objectives, and causes. But it also noted that the statutes in which all of this was operating was really focused on trying to enhance enterprise bargaining. So on that basis, it held that interests ought to be not only concerns, objectives, and causes, but the interests that are relevant to enterprise bargaining. And because the respondents generally wanted to implement attractive rostering arrangements, because they wanted to negotiate good terms with their employees to retain them, this suggested that they had common bargaining interests, and then overlaying that with all the other stuff, like they want to sell money through coal and their operations through digging coal, it was ultimately held that they have clearly identifiable common interests, and therefore that presumption was not rebutted.
And so even though the common interests about beneficial rostering or, you know, great terms and conditions, that could mean something quite different to one employer than it means to another employer, that's the detail is almost irrelevant. It's just the fact that we both want to be good employers and have good rosters and beneficial terms and conditions.
That's right. That's right. And I think the other interesting thing is the legislation does provide some guidance for determining common interests. And the legislation mentions geographic location, regulatory regimes, and nature of the enterprise. I think it's tick, tick, tick for those three.
Yeah.
But usually where the Fair Work Commission gets discretion, because of the statute, it says anything else that the commission considers appropriate or relevant. In this case, the statute doesn't say that. But
yeah.
We see the Fair Work Commission considering the interest as it pertains to enterprise bargaining.
Yeah. So you're right. We have to watch this space because it's currently on appeal to the federal court. So what are the key takeaways?
Yeah, so the key takeaways are, first and foremost, we know that these presumptions will apply, and the presumption not only applies in respect of the common interest, but also the reasonably comparable operations. And just quickly touching on that, the reasonably comparable operations and business activities test, the Fair Work Commission just attributed the ordinary meaning of those words and essentially said, reasonably comparable means more than merely or mere comparability, but otherwise, looking beyond just operations and business activities, it again focused on the employees and it looked at the work performed and how they'll affect bargaining. So really, we know that the Fair Work Commission's going to adopt a broad interpretation for the words that relate to these conditions. And we also know that the Fair Work Commission is going to really look at beyond just operations and business activities, but focus on how the employees' interests. And so therefore, I think in order to rebut the presumptions, the focus should be more than just advancing evidence on different locations or different equipment or different methods of operations. Really, evidence should be put forward showing that entering into a multi-enterprise agreement or entering into multi-enterprise bargaining will be disadvantageous for an employer's workforce. If that evidence can be put forward, that I think will be the key evidence and the key point to establishing that there's no common interests, there's no comparable operations, and ultimately that it's not in the public's interest to create that authorization. And as we said, these conditions also apply at the roping in stage.
We also said we were going to touch on intractable workplace declarations and determinations. And I appreciate that we've had your ears for quite some time. So we'll be very quick talking about this. But certainly, we've seen a lot of movement and a lot of activity in the Fair Work Commission with the intractable bargaining declarations and determinations. And Jai, that's really a new tool that the Fair Work Commission has now to assist with bargaining. And a declaration is essentially, or an intractable bargaining declaration is a declaration that is made by the Fair Work Commission in which they determine that there's no reasonable prospects that an agreement can be reached without the Commission actually making the declaration. And we've certainly seen, just in relatively recent times, many more declarations being, well, not many more, but a number of declarations being made quite recently.
So Lucy, how do you get that declaration and what's the impact of it?
So an application is made by a party, a bargaining representative, and the application, there needs to have been a minimum bargaining period that's ended, and that's the later of 9 months after the nominal expiry date of the existing agreement, or the day that is 9 months after a single interest employer authorisation came into operation. There needs to have been a dispute about the agreement that has been dealt with by the Fair Work Commission under Section 240, and the party applying for the declaration has to have participated in that. And there needs to be no reasonable prospect of agreement being reached. And once a declaration is made, there is an opportunity for further negotiation with the assistance of the Fair Work Commission so that they can use any of the tools that are available to them, conciliation, recommendation, expressing an opinion. And that post-negotiation declaration period can be for any period of time, 1 day, 7 days, 30 days. It's a period that's established by the Fair Work Commission. And then you head towards an intractable bargaining determination.
So what is the effect of such a determination?
Well, a determination effectively regulates the terms and conditions of employment. So it's effectively an enterprise agreement. And what the determination does is it contains the terms that are agreed between the bargaining representative, core terms, so nominal expiry date, mandatory terms, flexibility, consultation, dispute resolution. And then it also has to include terms that resolve the disputes between the parties. So it effectively is an arbitrated outcome to a dispute about terms and conditions of employment.
And what happens if you don't comply with the determination?
The same things that if you don't comply with the enterprise agreement. So the same provisions apply in respect of the requirement to comply. It essentially has the effect of an enterprise agreement once it's made.
So Lucy, what are some key takeaways that employers should have at mind?
I think you've always been able to get a determination in the Fair Work Commission. Until these most recent provisions, it was a lot harder. There had to be protected industrial action had to be terminated. That's quite hard to achieve. So I think now it's going to be a bit easier to get a determination. This will become potentially a strategy, a bargaining strategy. You'll continue bargaining until you get the declaration and the determination. So that's a factor that I think employers need to consider. And they also need to consider the offers that they make during the nine-month negotiation period. You'll often see an employer will put a proposed agreement to a vote, and it's likely that a Fair Work Commission in a determination will consider what that offer was as, you know, potentially a baseline or agreed terms and conditions. So it needs to be considered by employers as a part of the strategy for bargaining. So Both of these amendments have caused concerns for employers, and I think we're certainly going to see quite a bit of movement, particularly in determinations and direct declarations as time goes on. They're both watch this space situations, but something I think really that employers need to be across and really need to be mindful of, because it's possible both that the law will develop with in respect of both these amendments over time. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Lucy.